met my brother the other day and gave him my right hand. And just as soon as ever my back was turned, he went and scandalized my name. Now you call that a brother? No, no. You call that a brother? No, child, no. You call that a brother? No, no. Scandalizing my name.
Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, January 16th, 2010. I'm Harley Schlanger. I'll be your host today. You were just listening to an old spiritual about scandalizing my name. On today's program, we are going to be scandalizing several names, beginning with AIG and continuing with Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, who may soon be known as former Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who may also soon be known as former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Now, it's not just that the $180 billion bailout of AIG is an ongoing scandal, nor is it that Bernanke and Geithner have been and continue to be key figures in this scandal. The real scandal is that the President, the Congress, the media, and the American people have been tolerating such scandalous behavior as the swindle involving the $24 trillion and counting bailout. At least it appears that the American people are reaching the limits of their tolerance for such illegal, unconstitutional, and scandalous activity. Polls show that support for President Obama is plummeting and that incumbent congressmen in both parties are polling even lower than the president. Two more incumbents, a Democrat from Arkansas and a Republican from Arizona, announced yesterday their retirement at the end of this term. And the Democrats face the real prospect of a shocking defeat in next Tuesday's election in Massachusetts, which is being held to choose a replacement for the late Senator Ted Kennedy. So with the population angry and restless, we at the LaRouche Show will do our part today to stir up the scandals and point to those who should be removed for their roles in such blatantly unacceptable behavior. Our purpose is not just to identify and scold the perps, but to prepare you, our listeners, with the insight you need to move beyond scandal so you can become an organized force to restore our republic. Joining me on today's program is one who's been digging up banking and financial scandals since the early 1980s, John Hoeffel. And we'll also be joined by the co-host of a new weekly program on LaRouche Pact TV, Matthew Ogden, whose program, Campaign 2010, Down with the Traitors, premiered last week and will be up again with a new edition tomorrow night, Sunday night. So, John and Matthew, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
All right, John. Now, I want to start with AIG, just because we might as well get in on one of the really big scandals. What was new that turned up this week in the emails, and what are the implications of these revelations regarding AIG?
Well, Representative Darrell Issa released email traffic between the Fed and AIG, the New York Fed. And what it showed was the way in which the New York Fed basically ordered AIG not to reveal certain information in its filing with the SEC. Not only did they say we don't want this information disclosed, this information relating to the backdoor bailout of a bunch of big banks by paying off the government, effectively moving in to pay off these credit default swap bets at 100 cents on the dollar. But the Fed actually edited the SEC filing. You know, so you can see in the emails where they have the printouts with all the handwritten changes made at the Federal Reserve.
So it looks like my FBI files with a lot of redactions, John?
Oh, these were additions. They were redactions. They were crossing things out. You could still read it, but they would cross it out. And So here you have a very interesting thing. You have a private bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, issuing orders to a public company about what to put in a legally required securities filing. So how does the New York Fed get to order AIG to break U.S. securities laws? Because it appears that's what happened. And, of course, the head of the New York Fed at that point was our now Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner.
And, John, it would be hard to believe that the chairman of the Federal Reserve at that time, Ben Bernanke, who was in on all the discussions about the bailout of AIG, it's hard to believe that this would have been something he didn't know about, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because the other thing that these emails show and some of the other emails that have been released around the Bank of America Merrill Lynch case show is that the Fed is really micromanaging this. They're watching all of these things very closely. They're very active in shaping this environment in trying to basically save their central banking financial system at all costs. And that little things like legality, you know, they really just sort of brush them off. One of the interesting things is that we've heard repeatedly that we had no authority to do this. We had no authority to do this. There was no legal means to do that. And almost invariably, those things that they never could find the authority to do were things that would have protected us, the taxpayers.
Well, John, what I want to do is I want to break this down a little bit further for the gullible people among our listeners who think that the big scandal is that AIG paid something like $60 million in bonuses to the crooks and swindlers who came up with the whole credit default swap operation. Now, that is a bit of a scandal, the $60 million, but it pales in the face of what we're talking about, because we're talking about $60 billion that was essentially laundered through AIG to pay the counterparties. Now, who got that $60 billion?
Well, Goldman Sachs, for one.
Shocking.
It is. Bank of America and Merrill Lynch got a big chunk of it. Goldman Sachs got $13 billion, if I remember right. Bank of America and Merrill Lynch together got $12 billion. Deutsche Bank of Germany got $12 billion. Societe Generale of France got $12 billion. Hmm. So, they were passing this money out not only to U.S. banks, but to foreign banks.
And, John, what was the alleged reason to give the money to these banks?
Well, they said they didn't have the authority not to do so, that this was contractually bound, and that since the government wasn't putting AIG through bankruptcy proceedings, then these contracts had to be honored.
And the contracts, if I understand it, were based on the fact that these banks, including foreign banks, were buying these funny money assets from the AIG collateral debt obligation office in London. And that because these assets were of dubious value, AIG decided for the sake of good business practices that they would pay them off at 100 cents on the dollar. Is that right?
Yeah. AIG was, the AIG Financial Products operation out of London was a major writer of a type of credit derivative known as credit default swaps, which are sold as guarantees against defaults of certain bonds.
So this is part of what's called the spreading of the risk.
The spreading of the risk. And, of course, spreading of a risk is a euphemism for wicking away losses. Sharing the losses. Because you have this whole securities machine was set up to roll over debt, that we had to keep accumulating more and more debt because we no longer as a nation produced anything. And so, therefore, the only way we could survive was to keep borrowing money. So you set up this securities machine in order to keep rolling over the debt and selling all this worthless paper off into the financial markets.
Now, John, let's be clear on another thing. What you're calling worthless financial paper, Sir Alan Greenspan, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, was calling innovative financial products, was he not?
That's what he was calling it. And, you know, I hate to brag, but I think my track record on this is a little bit better than his.
Well, Greenspan did admit there might have been a flaw in the system. But from the period of 1999 through 2001, between the repeal of the Glass-Steagall bill and several direct initiatives taken by Greenspan at the Fed, they allowed this practice, and in fact, they encouraged it. Now, under the previous securities laws and Glass-Steagall, would this have been legal?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
So all of this became legal between 1999 and 2001, first by an act of Congress, backed by Larry Summers, another person who deserves some scandalizing, and also the Phil Gramm, Gingrich, and Greenspan were in on all this.
Yes, yes.
All right, now, one more question here right now. We hear from the Chris Dodd, Barney Frank proposals to reform the regulatory process that the Federal Reserve should play an increasing role in regulating these kinds of, to protect against these kinds of problems in the future. But didn't you just say that the Federal Reserve has now been caught red-handed approving minimally illegal and illicit actions?
Yes, yes, it has. And, of course, the Fed, it's not just enough to say that the Fed missed this whole bubble. The Fed helped build this thing. They helped create this mess, and then when it blows up, then you have basically Ben Bernanke is in, and he says, well, I'm the expert on the Great Depression, and now we know how to fix this. And how do they fix it? By pumping out even more money. So I would say that the Fed, you know, we have to shut down the Fed because they're part of the problem. And the Fed itself is unconstitutional. So on any level you want to take this thing, this it's an illegal operation.
Now, I know Mr. LaRouche again today reiterated his proposal that the Fed be put through bankruptcy reorganization and you sort out the good assets from the bad. And, of course, we all know without having Ron Paul's audit that the Fed is overloaded with worthless assets, that the Fed is bankrupt. So Mr. LaRouche was saying it should be shut down. But even while this is the necessary step, there is the question of Bernanke's reconfirmation. And this is supposed to come up on January 21st. The last I heard, John, there was a hold placed on this, which means if it's not done on the 21st, his term expires, I think, what, the 30th of January? So what happens with the Fed?
Well, that's the subject of some speculation. He would still remain a member of he would still remain a governor of the Fed. So either the vice chairman, Cohn, would take over, or some have said that Bernanke would be appointed interim chair.
Hmm.
But
in any case, we expect no changes in this policy, whether Bernanke's there or some other appointee comes in.
Well, you know, I think you could put a cardboard cutout in that position and the policy wouldn't change because the policy doesn't really come from the chairman. The policy comes from London.
And how does the policy of the U.S. Federal Reserve come from the city of London?
Well, the Federal Reserve is what is called an independent central bank. Now, of course, under our Constitution, only the U.S. Congress is authorized to create money, to issue utter money through credit. And so, but the Fed is part of a network of global central banks which are at the heart of this British imperial monetary system. And so the Fed is working closely with these other central banks to run this global system, and it's not really an institution in the U.S. And you know,
so that's why, John, you weren't surprised to find that the money was going through AIG to bail out foreign banks.
No, you know, President Obama likes to say the buck stops here, but somehow the buck always seems to find its way to London.
All right, well, you're listening to John Hofel, the economics and banking editor of the Executive Intelligence Review, and we're talking about some quite severe scandals. Now, we're not just scandal mongering. I mean, it's kind of interesting to go through this because this is something that Lyndon LaRouche has been warning about going back to the late 1970s when he talked about the effects of deregulation that were started with trucking and rail and so on. But, John, just to make this point, we've seen, in terms of banking, the initial deregulation started in 1980 and 82. And is there anything left to the U.S. banking system?
Very little. We have enough, we have a lot of regional, smaller banks, community banks, regional banks. We still have some 8,000 banks and savings and loans in the country, although the number is dropping pretty dramatically. But the problem is that because of the consolidation that has come as a result of the bankruptcy of these giant banks and the bailout, then the concentration of banking power in just a handful of institutions has been growing to the point where four institutions basically control about half of the U.S. banking system at this point.
Well, I saw Geithner, an interview with Geithner, where he was defending the AIG bailout, and of course, he and Bernanke have said repeatedly, as did President Bush and Vice President Cheney, former Treasury Secretary Paulson, and Larry Summers, and President Obama, have all said these steps, this bailout, this $24 to $30 trillion, of which AIG was an integral part, that this was an essential part of stabilizing the financial system. John, is the financial system stabilized because of this bailout?
They've only made it worse. What they have done, I mean, you have a debt crisis. You have a huge overload of debt and no production in order to pay for the debt service, or much less the principal. So you have an economy which is choking on its own debt. What they did as a way of solving the problem was they created more debt.
And John, it would seem to me that the starting point for real regulation would be to look at those four or five banks, or maybe there are 10 of them, which are called too big to fail. The argument being that if these banks are not protected, the whole system goes. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes. Yes, you have. And the definition of banks has been changing because, if you look at Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, were allowed to become bank holding companies, which gave them access to the Federal Reserve borrowing windows. But in theory, now, if you become a bank holding company, you're supposed to give up some of the activities that you were doing when you were an investment bank. You're supposed to change. But in fact, Goldman Sachs has been probably as much or more of a speculative entity since it became a bank holding company than it was before. So, you know, these things, what's happening is that the parasitic side, the theft side of these investment banks, the casino side of it, is the one that's making the money because they're basically stealing from the rest of the economy.
Whereas, and that's called a recovery.
Yeah. Whereas the traditional banking functions, you know, are dying because the economy upon which they depend is dying. So the speculators are making all the money. The real banking system is dying, and it's exactly the opposite of what we need to do, which is to shut down the speculators and save the real banking system.
All right. Well, I think our listeners from that initial discussion can see that this is indeed quite a big scandal. If you have some questions for John or Matthew, you can email us at radio@larouchepub.com, and we'll take your questions in the second part of the show. I'd like to bring on now Matthew Ogden, who's been doing a significant amount of work on this question of Glass-Steagall. And this is something that Mr. LaRouche has said, we have to go back to Glass-Steagall standards in banking. Matthew, what do we mean by that?
Well, there's a lot of debate around right now. A lot of different people are talking about Glass-Steagall, but none of them intend the same thing that LaRouche is talking about when he says we have to restore the Glass-Steagall Act of Franklin Roosevelt to dictate how we're going to have the bankruptcy reorganization of the banking system. The truth about Glass-Steagall, in the way that LaRouche is talking about it, is that it has to be seen as a weapon to be used by the American patriots to free our republic from the control of this international monetary empire, which is based in London and in part on Wall Street, what John was just discussing. We're going to be making a video on this very subject here at LaRouche PAC, which will be posted within about a week or so. People should watch out for it. But the key with Glass-Steagall is to not only go back to Franklin Roosevelt. You can see Franklin Roosevelt's passage of Glass-Steagall and the entirety of the Banking Act of 1933 as a reaffirmation of what was already implicit in the Hamiltonian principles of the U.S. Constitution, what Alexander Hamilton wrote.
I'm sure you've read some of these speeches and statements by President Roosevelt, who is explicit that this was to take power away from private speculators and put the economy back to work.
Precisely. And the language which Roosevelt used proves that he understood who the enemy was. If you look at his speech to the 1932 Democratic Convention when he was nominated, he talked about the party of Toryism, which he thought had been flushed out of this country way back in 1776, he said rhetorically. He talked about the economic royalists. And if you understand Glass-Steagall in the way that Roosevelt understood it and in the way that Hamilton understood it, you will understand it as as part of an ongoing war against not the British Empire as just the Redcoats as we recognize them from the American Revolution, but the British Empire as an international monetarist system, which even after Cornwallis's surrender at Yorktown was still our enemy and something which we had not gained independence from in reality yet. And that's what Hamilton understood.
And Matthew, when John McCain, Senator John McCain, signs on to a bill that says he wants Glass-Steagall, he's not talking about going after the British Empire, is he?
Well, we're going to make sure that that's what's understood by Glass-Steagall once we get done with it. People, when they hear Glass-Steagall, whether John McCain intends it or not, people are going to be thinking about Alexander Hamilton as the young colonel jumping over the fortifications at Yorktown and bayoneting British soldiers, and then the very next minute turning around and creating a national bank to protect our banking system from the monetarist empire. That's what we want to be the idea connected with this.
All right, now this is an important point because I know you talk to them. I talk to a lot of the populace. I'm sure John is following the discussion. You have a lot of people who want to get rid of the Federal Reserve, including Ron Paul and a lot of his supporters. But then they turn around and say, well, the Federal Reserve is a private bank, but we don't need a national bank either. We're opposed to centralization. So how do you explain to people who correctly see the Federal Reserve as an illegal, unconstitutional, private parasite, but oppose the idea of national banking? What is it they're missing?
Well, they don't understand LaRouche's economics. They don't understand the difference between a monetary system, as you can see it demonstrated in LaRouche's triple curve, and a credit system, which we've recently tried to illustrate with what we've called the double curve. And John Hofel also knows a lot about this. But the video that we'll be putting out, and people can watch out for this, we're going to attempt to demonstrate the principle of a bankruptcy reorganization. It's not just getting rid of Bernanke or auditing the Federal Reserve, which is going to convert not only the U.S. economy, but what we have to do globally, convert the global economy from the current monetary system, where money itself is seen as a standard for value and money has been commoditized and has latched onto our otherwise functional financial system and caused our financial system to act as a host for this monetary parasite instead of as an engine for the financing through credit of physical economic development projects.
All right, now we have a response from someone who I think is probably honestly trying to grapple with this question. I'll throw this open to John, but I think what Matthew said was getting at his question. Someone named whose email address is Melvin Vandentop, and he writes, "To hear you guys talk, it seems everything is wrong, and you are the only hope for the future. Do you acknowledge any allies working along a positive path, or do you continue to insist that unless everything is resolved as you understand it to be best, that all humanity is doomed?" And he writes, "Just wondering, is there anything to celebrate in all this?" John, what would you say to our friend Melvin?
Well, I would say that, yeah, there's a lot to celebrate because we have the empire is basically destroying itself at this point. So we have an opportunity here to really change the geometry of the planet, to go back to sovereign nations, to get rid of this empire, sovereign nations, a credit system, fixed exchange rates, begin to produce things again. This is a tremendous opportunity. It's also a very dangerous time. And there are a lot of people around the world, including people in the United States, who would like to do this. The real problem is that most of them have been scared because they know what happens to people who buck the system. But as the system collapses, then it really does open the door for a lot of people to start stepping forward. So it gives us a real opportunity.
Well, John, I'd like to just add my two cents on this because I think it's a useful question because, as you point out, there are plenty of potential allies. There are many people, the vast majority of the population is rejecting the crazy British policies that President Obama is pushing, whether it's his fascist health care plan, whether it's the discredited cap and trade policy, or the question of the continuing bailout. There's a majority of people from all parties, all the political spectrum, who would reject this. Now, the question then becomes, how do you put together a positive solution? And I would just point out, there's a lot of debate at the Constitutional Convention. And I think people like Ben Franklin and his allies insisted that there is a right way to do it, and that they had pulled together what they thought was the right way based on their study of history and science. And Melvin, I'd encourage you to read LaRouche's two most recent papers, which are available on LaRouche PAC website, one on national banking, and then the other most recent one. I forget the title of that. Maybe one of you can help me with that. But it goes into this question of how do you scientifically determine what measures will work from the standpoint of energy policy and investment policy. So we have plenty of allies out there. The problem is that, as John said, some of them are frightened, and in the other case, some of them have just not taken the time to actually study the traditions and the history of this nation, as Matthew was talking about it earlier. So, Melvin, I'd encourage you to not be pessimistic or cynical, but to go on our website and take up these ideas from LaRouche. Now, Matthew, we've been doing a lot of work in Purcellville on the question of national banking. You mentioned the Glass-Steagall video that you're working on. What other material do we have up on the website that people could use to get a better sense of this?
Well, just to tell you, the other paper you're referring to is called A New World Credit System, The Question
That's
Before
right.
Us. That's actually, we're putting a lot together on that. We posted a video about 2 weeks ago which gave an overview of the entire LaRouche plan and three crucial components of it. One subject was the necessity for killing the Obama health care bill and restoring Hill-Burton. That goes very closely along with what we were talking about with AIG and the bailout for these insurance companies. The second aspect of that video was a preliminary look at how to create a third national bank on the precedent of Hamilton's first and the second national bank. And then the third item on that video was a review quickly of how we would create a new civilian conservation corps type program using the abundant credit which the banks, after they're liberated from this huge monetarist parasite, will be freed up to create and to extend to productive projects, magnetically levitated rail, building the Nuapa, replenishing the Ogallala Aquifer in the west, and so forth, and how the young people in this country, especially young people in the inner cities who are have outstanding levels of unemployment, higher than we've seen since the Second World War, since the end of the Second World War, will be first given sufficient training to qualify them for working on productive projects, building infrastructure, and then will be employed in these projects and given the skills necessary to enter into a productive workforce to get the country back on the road toward recovery within a generation or so. So we're going to have a more detailed video on that posted later this week also.
So these are things that, people such as Melvin and others who are interested can go on LaRouchePAC.com, and you can see the work that's being done out of the LaRouche Youth Movement team in Purcellville, Virginia, and in the basement at Windy Hill. Now, again, we have plenty of time for your email questions. I'd encourage people who want to know things such as this last question of why are we so certain, what do we know, where do these ideas come from? If you have those questions or just how to organize, send them in to radio@larouchepub.com. John, I'd like your comments on a discussion I had with an economist the other day who said that LaRouche is absolutely right by focusing on AIG, and he said that the so-called health care bill, which is really an insurance bailout in addition to being a bill that will kill off the poor and the elderly and the sick, but he said this health care bill is a backdoor bailout for the insurance companies, because by mandating 16 to 30 million new policyholders, there's a new income stream, that some of which will come from the government, which he said is the basis for leverage, in other words, creating massive borrowing by the banks and insurance companies to create a new toxic asset bubble. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think he knows what he's talking about. The idea of, I mean, why would you force Americans to have to buy insurance? What's the purpose of that? You're funneling enormous amounts of money, assuming that people can afford to pay their premiums. You're funneling enormous amounts of money into the insurance companies. Now, insurance companies are really finance companies, financial companies. They take in the premiums and they invest it in all sorts of securities and things. They buy a lot of the toxic waste that Wall Street likes to sell.
So weren't they in the past, weren't there more regulations from the state level that prevented insurance companies from going into speculative finance?
Yeah, there are, and there were, and there still are a lot of things that stop them from doing that. But this is where you get into the collusion between the rating agencies and the securities issuers, because the insurance companies are only supposed to buy top-rated securities because they're supposed to be safe, because this is not really their money. It's the public money in terms of premiums paid in that will be owed back to policyholders at some point in the future. So, but if you have a system where you have these rating agencies, which are just rubber stamping for a fee, all of these ridiculous securities as AAA rated, then they can be sold off to pension funds and insurance companies and other things. So you've had a mixed process where you've had gradual loosening of regulations to permit them to buy more and more of this toxic waste, because in fact the system is geared towards producing all this toxic waste and making sure that institutions which have no business buying it do indeed buy it. So the whole thing is just a giant scam and a giant ripoff, which, as we have now seen, has blown up in their faces, but it's also blown up in our faces.
And what we're seeing then on top of this is a legitimate anger in the population against these policies. So we have a question from Brian up in the Bay Area, who's a union member, a Democratic Party activist, and I can tell you someone who's not too happy with the Obama administration. But he asks the question, how do we ensure that the mass strike process that we're seeing as a reaction against these policies stays in a positive direction and doesn't just go off into anarchy or chaos or right-wing populism? Matthew, you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I think one of the keys is to realize that we have a slate of LaRouche Democrats who are running for Congress. Keisha Rogers in Texas, Summer Shields in the Bay Area, and Rachel Brown, who's running against Barney Frank up in Massachusetts. And between the three of these candidates, we just had a very high-profile press conference at the National Press Club this past Tuesday. We had a rally down at Capitol Hill with these three candidates. They're back in their districts now. Between the three of them, they represent the personification of the LaRouche plan, and they represent the leadership faction among a new generation of leadership who are coming in and providing the necessary beacon for which the mass strike has to which the mass strike has to orient. So we're engaged in a process with these three campaigns on the ground of educating the next phase of this mass strike, and that's what people have to orient towards.
Now, if we look at the polls that we're seeing, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, we're seeing the Obama popularity drop week by week. We're seeing the popularity of Congress fall through the floor. A growing number of people have turned against the health care bill. It's now well over 50% oppose this bill. I think there's under 30% who are strongly for it. So it's clear that there's a shift in the popular opinion. But this doesn't seem to be getting through to Wall Street. And John, I'd like your thoughts on the hearings this week where Phil Angelides, you know, someone who was a California political figure, was badly beaten by Arnie Schwarzenegger, partly because the Democratic Party was so dysfunctional. But Angelides has a committee that had a hearing. You had the titans and the masters of the universe from Wall Street, Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs and Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan Chase, John Mack from Morgan Stanley, and a newcomer, Moynihan, from the Bank of America. What did we learn from these hearings, John? There was a lot of coverage of it, but what really did we learn from it?
Well, we already knew that the bankers are liars, so we didn't learn anything there. We know that, in general, these investigations don't really have any teeth, even though there might be some people involved who would like to do something with it. But, you know, the problem with these investigations is that if you want to get serious, you have to do what Ferdinand Pecora did in the Pecora Commission hearings under FDR, which means you need political backing. But you have to call these guys in and you have to make them squirm. You don't just embarrass them. You humiliate them. You force them to make mistakes and expose. The purpose is to expose the corruption, the sleazy corruption of Wall Street to the American people as a way of building support for re-regulation, serious re-regulation.
So they really should be doing some scandalizing in these hearings.
Absolutely. They should be going after these people with a vengeance. Because you look at, you know, Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs, who says, I'm doing God's work. But his bank is raping and pillaging the economy. You know, so what God is he talking about?
Well, they did give $1 million for Haiti.
Yeah, but that's probably to pay off debt owed to them.
It's probably his daily tip money.
And then you have this other clown, Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan Chase, who's been going around complaining that he's getting tired of all the constant vilification of the bankers by the public. Well, you know, quit stealing from us.
Maybe he'd be interested in going down to an unemployment line somewhere or a soup kitchen and tell them he's tired of being, have his chauffeur drop him off there or his private pilot drop him off and have him tell them that he doesn't like to be vilified.
Yeah, I think that would work real well. You know, the problem is these guys live in a bubble. And they think that their world is the real world, and their world is crumbling around them, and they're all about to find out that they're not the real world, that there is a real world out there, and that it's not very happy with them.
Well, John, just as Matthew was talking earlier about the difference between LaRouche's Glass-Steagall and what some other people are throwing out there using the name but not really having an idea of how to use it, there was talk that the Angelides Committee was trying to do something like Pecora. What was the difference? What did Ferdinand Pecora do that these guys aren't doing?
Well, Pecora he called them in, and what he would do is he would get them to lie, and then he would produce proof, well, you know, you're lying. This, the facts don't back up what you said. So how do you explain that? And then they would start stammering and they would say something stupid.
You know, at one point, we saw an article published by Eliot Spitzer, the former Attorney General of New York, and William Black, the former head of the FSLIC, the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, which actually was a kind of PCORA prosecutor's manual for this. Did you get a chance to look at that?
I glanced at it briefly, but refresh my memory on this.
Well, they had questions such as, when did you stop beating your wife? And it's clear that the way they posed the questions, they already knew the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that the bankers would have to lie to cover up, and then they could produce the evidence. That's exactly what you were saying that PCORA did.
Mm-hmm. But, the main thing, I think, is intent. That you're not calling these powerful people in there to express your displeasure with them. You're calling these punks in to grill them and to show them that they don't run the country, we do. And that they're out of business. We're putting an end to their criminal operations. And you have to be serious. That's the main thing. You really have to be serious. You're not just going to criticize these people. We're taking them down. We're going to change this system.
Now, Matthew, I think that to go back to the question we had earlier about how do you deal with disagreements on these things, do you just assert your authority? In a certain way, that's legitimate if your authority is based on science and history. I assume that you've looked into the fight around the National Bank and the fight around public credit at Hamilton's time. There wasn't unanimity around the Hamilton policy at all, was there?
No way. Hamilton had to, if you look at a lot of what he wrote in the Federalist Papers and otherwise, Hamilton had to argue for the necessity of a national bank in order to bring into reality the ideas which were expressed on paper in the United States Constitution under the General Welfare Clause and otherwise. And you had traitors who came in later and repealed the National Bank, took it down, like Andy Jackson, who's now celebrated as a great Democrat. That probably shows you why some other Democrats, like Barney Frank, are not quite to be considered patriots.
Or that other great Democrat, Aaron Burr, who killed Hamilton.
Yeah, right.
And J.P. Morgan Chase has the pistols on display.
Is this true?
Yeah, they have the pistol that killed Aaron Burr. The pistol that Aaron Burr used to kill Hamilton on display.
Well, so this is as Anton Chaitkin, the historian, has asserted, there's a thread of treason in this country that goes back to the people who never could take the victory of the Americans in the Revolution and have been trying to overturn it ever since. This is the J.P. Morgan Chase tradition, isn't it, John?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. If there's one bank that you could say that has been the British bank involved in selling out the United States of America, it would be J.P. Morgan.
That's
Although in recent years, Goldman Sachs has certainly been giving them a run for their money.
I think that's an important aspect of what you were talking about with the PCORA Commission also. What Roosevelt did with the PCORA Commission was to use it to show, to expose the names and the faces of the people who were directly the British agents inside Wall Street who had subverted and destroyed the United States economy, and to expose this to the American people, to reignite the patriotic spirit that the American people have, to say we're not going to let these traitors destroy our country. And he exposed back then, PCORA did, that J.P. Morgan had a whole preferred list of the people who had already engaged in treason, trying to rob Franklin Roosevelt of the nomination in the 32 convention, and then the people who were later implicated in the coup d'etat plot that was exposed by Smedley Butler to get rid of Franklin Roosevelt. These are real traitors.
And I think a part of what we do, besides the attempt to bring levity to this question by scandalizing these guys, is actually to show that there is a history to the United States which has been mostly hidden, and which has been revived by the efforts of Lyndon LaRouche over the last 40 years. John, you have some comments on that?
Yeah, we changed the world. The United States of America and our Declaration of Independence and Constitution represent the high water mark for Western civilization. And we were founded as a beacon of hope for the world, including for Europe, because a lot of the people who founded this country had come from Europe explicitly to get away from this oligarchic system and create a place that we could, that they could use as a base for fixing the problems of Europe and leading the world in a new direction. And for a long time we did. And now one of the problems that we've had with this is we've been under consistent British attack. That if you look at the role of the House of Morgan in co-opting the American system of economics and trying to take it over and stop it, you know, that's been, that this kind of financial warfare has been one of the major factors in stopping us from being what we're supposed to be. And now we get to the point where this kind of financial warfare has blown up the country completely. And what's the alternative? What is our two successive administrations? What do? They side with the empire. They bail out the empire, and they cut the rest of the country loose. They let, you know, let the public suffer in order to save these parasites. And all we have to really do to get back to what we were before is to reverse that. You know, give these parasites a flea dip. And go back to the principles of the American system, because it works. It works very well, and that's why they hate it so much.
Matthew, as an early recruit to the LaRouche Youth Movement, you've been involved in organizing quite a bit, talking to young people all over the country about restoring this idea of the patriotic tradition of the United States. How difficult is it to get young people to take this seriously and to think about it and to work through these ideas? Do you find people get excited about it?
Well, history is very exciting when you present it in a real way. When you try to rob people of a sense of passion about their connection to history and their ability to make history, that's when people become alienated and they try to cut themselves off from responsibility for the world around them. But the minute that you give a young person the sense that they can make history, and there is a real principle behind the development of our nation's history and world history over hundreds of years, which they can understand, and they can step right into the river and take up the fight from people that came before them. That tends to be very exciting for young people, and I think that's one reason why you've seen the LaRouche Youth Movement become the de facto leadership of the United States over the past 6 years, 7 years, as we've matured in our intellectual leadership capability.
And part of that maturing is actually studying these founding documents, not simply reading the Constitution, but going back and looking at someone who very few Americans know, Leibniz, who actually provided the philosophical framework that Benjamin Franklin incorporated in the Constitution. To what extent do you think we're having some success at getting people to look back at these European roots? Because Lyndon LaRouche talks about it all the time.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that we're discussing around here at Percival is if you place yourself in the shoes of people like Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, like you were mentioning earlier, Harley, who were having the deliberations and the fights over what shape would the emerging American Republic take, and what, informed by former history all the way back to the Greeks, in what form of government would function the best and would provide the best vehicle for the kinds of ideas which they were fighting for. If you put yourself in the shoes of those people and then think about the situation that we find ourselves in today, when we're looking at a potentially brand new phase in history. We secured the American Republic and the idea of a national credit system in the end of the 1700s around the fight for the Constitution. We did that, but what we haven't done yet, and what LaRouche mentions in his newest paper about the four power solution, we haven't secured that as a world system. We haven't created a collaboration between sovereign nation states, but sovereign nation states who are linked together in a collaborative effort towards securing the common aims of mankind. And when you think about how exciting it is that we have the chance to do what Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton and others did for the United States, we have the chance to do that for the world. All of a sudden, ideas which were formerly just dead, maybe on pieces of paper, maybe you would read about it in a textbook somewhere or something like that, all of a sudden these ideas come to life and they gain newfound power. And when you dedicate your life to that, you find a completely different sense of identity. And that's what we need to give to young people. That's what's going to save civilization.
Well, we also saw in the agreement, the novel agreement between Russia and China, which had a Hamiltonian use of credit, we're seeing that there are other countries, in particular the ones that LaRouche singled out as three of the four powers, Russia, India, and China, sovereign nations that do not accept this paradigm of financial innovation of Greenspan and Bernanke and are looking for an alternative. John, we've seen more following up that October Russia-China agreement. We've seen more evidence of the Asian countries in particular moving toward this new paradigm, which is really the LaRouche paradigm.
Yeah, but they realize that they will be destroyed by the empire. As the empire tries to save itself, it's going to basically loot everything it can, and that these nations are being targeted for destruction. And so if they intend to survive as nations, and if they intend to protect their people, then they have to break with the system. And if you're going to break with this system, there's only really one place to go, and that's with the LaRouche plan, with the ideas of the American system, and going back to production and going back to defending your nation and increasing your productive powers and increasing your use of energy, flux density, nuclear power, these sorts of things in order to transform your country and become productive powers as opposed to financial powers. And that's what you have to do, and they realize that.
Well, 2 weeks from today, we will not be having a LaRouche show because Lyndon LaRouche will be giving a webcast. It will be a special Saturday webcast on January 30th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you're on the East Coast and would like to attend, get in touch with your local LaRouche office and see if you can arrange to come down for it. But the topic will be pulling together this new four-power agreement. And I know there's been a lot of discussion of this. And again, Matthew, to go back to this, the paradigm of the last 40 years has clearly failed. Now, what's holding people back from taking up LaRouche's challenge of bringing the United States into accord with the other three powers? What do you think's holding people back?
That's a good question. That's what I ask myself every day. I think there's a lot of fear that people have. Also, though, I think the problem is, you've had a situation where you don't have the leadership apparent for people. I think the situation, though, where people are feeling the betrayal from what they had so much hope that they had invested in Obama and so forth and so on, the betrayal that people feel from that and what we saw starting in August of this year in the town hall meetings and what we've dubbed the growing mass strike among the American population, I think that represents a situation where, in fact, you are seeing a recognition among the among people in the United States that what they thought, that maybe they haven't thought about it as deeply as, you know, the axioms that they've held about economics have proven to be wrong or something like that. But what they thought were guaranteed rights that would always be there, all of a sudden have evaporated. That's thrown people into a situation where they have to reassess what's true and false. They have to reassess what they thought was guaranteed and all of a sudden is no longer there. And we're having there's a transformation among the people of the United States where if we do our job right, people will not just be yelling at their congressmen and saying, hey, listen to what we have to say, which is good, but people will be telling their congressmen, look, buddy, you better clear out your desk because we're taking your job. That's what we hope to see coming up next week in Boston. we're anticipating some big fireworks in this election for Ted Kennedy's old seat.
Well, if you are in Massachusetts and you have the opportunity to do so, that is, you're a registered voter, you can express your contempt for this health care bill by making sure that Martha Coakley does not end up going into the U.S. Senate. And I think the issue there explicitly is that, and this exposes the hypocrisy of this administration, where Obama says we're taking on the insurance companies and the drug companies. No, in fact, it's the insurance companies and the HMOs who are pouring money into Massachusetts to elect the Democrat Martha Coakley. Why? Because she'll vote for this health care policy if she's elected. And I think the people of Massachusetts are smart enough to know that, and that they don't like being taken for granted, do they, Matthew? As someone who lived up there for a couple of years, it may take a while to get someone in Massachusetts angry, but the issue of the British Empire still does seem to rile people up there.
Oh, there's a great tradition among both people who have patriots in the American Revolution in their heritage, and among the Irish as well.
All right, so we just have a couple of minutes. John, let me come back to you, because I know you and I have talked about this, that scandalizing is not always the best way to go about things, because a lot of people who scandalize then sit back and say, okay, I took care of business, now I can let them continue to do what they're doing. But there is a useful aspect to showing the corruption and fraud and the swindle, is there not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What you want to do is you want to find the people who are willing to do something about it and show them what has happened in a way that they can really understand, so that they're mad enough that they're going to go out and take back control of their government. Because you can't do this with some, you know, anarchy. You can't do this with anything but using the principles of our Constitution and regaining control of our government and making it a sovereign government. And if we do that, we have all the power we need to fix all of these problems. And so what we can show is we can show the way in which this imperial force has taken over our government, in effect. We're being run by a foreign force. Obama, you know, for all of his talk, is basically a British stooge. That what they're imposing is corporatism, which was the Mussolini fascism, and it's the big moneyed interest which are taking over and increasingly dominating everything, and we can stop that, but we have to expose it.
That's the important point. It can be stopped. It depends on the American people. Now, Matthew, what's going to be on your program, Down with the Traitors, Campaign 2010? What are you going to do in the program Sunday night, and how do people find it?
Okay, you go to the LaRouche Pack website. We have a new link on the front page with a very attractive, some very attractive artwork with a whole row of congressional faces called Down with the Traitors Campaign 2010. It's a weekly show. Tomorrow night, what we're going to be featuring is the footage from the press conference, the LaRouche Democrat congressional candidates press conference from Washington, D.C. We'll also have some footage of the rally we had down at Capitol Hill on the same day. Also, I understand there was a big Martha Coakley rally at Copley Square in downtown Boston yesterday, which we had Rachel Brown, the candidate for Congress running against Barney Frank. She was out with her banner announcing her campaign outside this hotel, and we were ready to receive all of the Democrats and otherwise who were coming out of this event. So I understand we have some footage of that also, which we'll be featuring. And just to announce, I think, Harley, you're going to be going to Boston next week to an event that Rachel Brown is hosting in Boston, a town hall meeting.
Yes, next Saturday, I believe is it 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock? It's going to be at the Hyatt Hotel downtown Boston, and it will be Rachel Brown, and I'll be there with her. And anyone in the Boston area should call our office to get the details and come out. That's next Saturday. And Matthew, your program will be up tomorrow night, is that right, the next edition?
Yeah, tomorrow afternoon.
All right. Well, we've got some work to do. I think people should not just wait and see what's going to happen Tuesday, but stir things up. If you know anyone in Massachusetts, give them a call. We've got to defeat this Nazi health care bill. We're out of time. John and Matthew, thank you very much. I think we shed some light not just on the scandals, but on what to do about scandals. And so until next week, this is Harley Schlanger. Thank you for joining us on The LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the LaRouchePub.com website.